Ay, ay,
hey.
Ay,
¡hey!
Bakkie Bakkie, seizoen 2, aflevering 6.
Wat ontzettend lekker dat je luistert.
Deze uitzending wordt voor 99% mogelijk gemaakt door onze lieve vrienden.
Van
die,
het
die klasbakken.
Van het verrassend frisse pils.
In dat mooie witte matte blikje.
Zo mat dat alsof glans er geen vat op heeft.
De flesjes zijn groen.
Ja. De lucht is blauw.
Het bier is goud.
Cornuit, ik hou van jou.
Dankjewel. Dankjewel, Cornuit.
Dankjewel. Echte vrienden noem je...
Cornuiten.
Vrienden.
Precies. En die andere 1% die krijgen we van een paar andere hele lieve mensen.
Mensen die inzien dat de wereld een betere plek wordt... zolang wij gewoon...
hier kunnen zitten en dit kunnen doen.
Exactamundo.
Het zijn mensen die hun ziel wassen. Met een paar dollartjes in de maand. Op een lekkere manier.
Geen greenwash, geen whitewash, nee, soulwash.
Precies.
Dus als je een klein stukje van ons wil, als je een klein stukje wil bijdragen, dan kan dat gewoon nog steeds op patreon.com.
/bakkiebakkie.
Want dat
als je een beetje doneert, je kan zomaar ineens een officieel Van Lummeltje aan je muur hebben.
Hartstikke idee.
Een bakkiebakkie t-shirt.
Een stickertje
erbij.
Ook
nog steeds gewoon een ding. We moeten wat nieuwe mensen verwelkomen. Thijs van Bijsterveld verdient wel even een flinke shout-out.
Ja, Thijs, kom eens even. Hey, kom eens even hier. Op. Niet het halfslachtige geknuffel. Gewoon echt even beet pakken.
Je t-shirt is onderweg. Yes. Sven Hooghuis is er ook bij.
Sven. Wat een mooie naam.
Komt de tekening jouw kant op.
Helemaal.
Ook Thijs, die krijg je ook nog trouwens.
Ja.
Stan Koppen.
Stan.
Kan kloppen.
Ik moest aan koffiekoppen. Rembo.
Ja,
kijk die nog maar eens een keertje, maar vind ik nog te genieten. YouTube.
Ik moest er niet aan denken.
Nee, ik wel.
Martijn Swinkels, dat is wel even een bijzonder verhaal. Want,
ja,
Martijn die is namelijk patron geworden als cadeau voor een ander. En dat vind ik toch een gebaar van het allerbovenste plankje.
Ja, dat is ongelooflijk. Tegelijkertijd denken wij, Martijn, je had ook wel de helft van de hoeveelheid woorden kunnen gebruiken.
Dat
maar
denk
goed,
ik ook, ja.
Maar goed, dat is allemaal.
De man of the hour is dan Huub Everts, beste vriend van Martijn. Hij is,
Huub.
Hij is jarig.
Ja, jongen. En het is natuurlijk iets dat gebeurt ieder jaar. Dat kan je niet kwalijk nemen, dat kan je niet... Maar alsnog gefeliciteerd, Huub.
29 jaar.
Ik hoop dat je een zalige dag hebt.
Dat hoop ik ook. Ik weet nog dat ik 29 was. Het waren mooie tijden.
Ik ben het vergeten.
Man, dat wordt...
Ach.
Je staat nog wat te wachten, jongen.
En dan
we kunnen verder nog wat vertellen over Huub. Huub is altijd de eerste op de dansvloer.
Ja.
Hij is
zo eentje dat, ook al is het niet heel erg warm, dat op een gegeven moment dan staat hij toch buiten zijn t-shirt uit te wringen.
Uiteindelijk wel, want hij wordt echt zeik en zeik en zeik en zeik nat.
Hij staat in principe ieder weekend de stoep te squirten.
Ja, ja.
Dat gevoel, dat idee. Was William niet ook nog...
William, absoluut. William Joko.
William Joko.
Vriend van de show is ook langs geweest als je die aflevering niet hebt geluisterd. Nu doen.
Nu doen.
Nu.
Oké, gaan we even er naartoe scrollen, jongen. Maak jou uit. Dankjewel nog voor alle knietips, William. Mijn knie brother.
Ja, Steve loopt nog steeds met krukken. Dat is nog steeds... heeft dat Tomorrowland dingetje in de sneeuw.
Welke aflevering kunnen we dat ook weer terugluisteren?
Ja, weet ik niet meer.
Het zit
ergens. Het is een Easter egg. Zoek het
diep,
op.
Diep erin.
Je gaat
diep.
Ervan genieten.
Hartstikke diep. Diep.
Goed. Over tot de orde van de dag. We hebben een legend. Die kwam gewoon aanwaaien. Een man die aan het begin van een tijdperk stond. Een man die samen met twee andere mannen per ongeluk techno heeft uitgevonden.
En allerlei verrassende dingen zijn er voren gekomen. Het is... In principe grootstedelijke muziek gemaakt rondom een vijver.
Ja, in een Phoenixwijk.
Ja.
We hebben het over Detroit, maar eigenlijk komt het gewoon uit Zoetermeer. Het Zoetermeer van Detroit.
Nou, jij zegt het. Ik hou me angstvallig op de achtergrond. Dames en heren, hier is Bakkie Bakkie seizoen 2 aflevering
6 met de one and only
Kevin Sons.
Everybody has a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Did you finish?
There are almost. I finished that one.
Actually, it's funny though, because I mean, as we explained, "baki baki" is slang for a cup of coffee, and then it was one of the things that we said, like, every time we want to ask people how to drink their coffee, but a lot of times we forget about it. And you arrived, and the first thing was like, "Give me a cup of coffee, but I'm a cappuccino type of guy."
That's right. I just had to be straight, because I know, like, when I'm getting coffee from Nicole over there, they always have the hard time trying to figure out how to get some milk. So I said, let me just let this cat out the bag right now. And so, yeah.
Well, I really like the phrase, I'm a cappuccino type of guy.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that says something about the vibe, actually. Cappuccinos.
There you go.
Like, smooth. Yeah. You know?
And then a shout out, of course, to the girls from the museum at Hem, that they walked all the way from the other side of the building.
Oh, wow.
To bring you two cappuccinos.
2.5 hours.
definitely give a shout out for that.
Yeah. Have you always been a cappuccino kind of guy?
Yeah, you know, or I had to have milk in it, one of the two, you know, so preferably cappuccino. Obviously, cappuccino wasn't around like years ago, but, you know, as it evolved, it was just a better version of a milk coffee, you know.
I mean, it's crazy how coffee evolved, actually. I mean, it became sort of, people are being fancy about it.
Oh, yeah.
All over the world. You got all these.
Changed. It's evolved and just grew in so many different ways.
I mean, if you order a coffee nowadays, it's like, do you want Peruvian or, you know, I just want a regular coffee.
It's a little bit too complicated, but I guess it works for some people, right? That's for sure. I remember when I was, maybe 8 years old. So to drink coffee, it's like amazing if you can get some coffee, right? You just wanted some coffee, but you always thought, no, you can't have no coffee, you're too young. So my grandmother, she would always give me coffee. So for breakfast, I'd go in there, and it was a small cup too. It was really small, and it would have milk, and she put that sugar in it, and it was like, wow. So that's how
you were drinking coffee when you were 8 years old.
Yes, I was.
It's your grandma that made you a cappuccino type of guy.
Exactly. Yeah, that's why. That's how.
What was your grandma's situation like?
Well, she had 13 kids. So
13 kids.
Yeah, she raised 13 kids and probably who knows how many grandkids. But my grandparents, they lived like on a farm. In Inkster, a suburb of Detroit. And they were farm, really, kind of people. Grew their own food. And, you know, when the grandkids came over, you worked in the farm. And she would just took care of the household. That's all she didn't work. She just worked at home. Because with 13 kids, you know, that's all you can do is take care of your kids. And obviously, as they grew up, the kids started helping because they're old enough to help as the younger ones, you know, are young. So.
And was this an active farm, like with animals or making cheese? No,
it was just straight up vegetables and fruits, stuff like that. And it was mainly for the family to eat because they had so many kids and you know, grandkids or whatever and all of that and brothers and sisters. And so it was really for our own being. And then I think they sold some to the neighborhoods and stuff like that, like that type of thing.
What a change in one life, right? From growing your own crops to playing the house and techno music.
Yes, it's totally different. But it's weird because okay, so I'm originally from New York, which was obviously Mad City, Brooklyn, Flatbush. Grew up there for whatever, 9-10 years. Moved to the suburbs of Detroit, which was semi-country, but not completely country. Then I moved to Belleville, where I met Derek May and Juan Atkins, which is really the beginning of techno, where as we joined together in Belleville, which was totally the country, like seriously, lakes and woods and forests, and we came up with this, you know, the combination of us created our own musical path to lead to, you know, to this electronic sound from the country.
I mean, this is probably a misconception, at least from my part, because it's, I mean, Chicago, Detroit, Motor Cities. I mean, and this music also feels like a reflection on these industrial cities. But then you created it in this peaceful environment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but I think we all had some form of the city, you know, because Juan and Derek, they lived in Detroit before they lived in Belleville, and I lived in New York. So at some point, there was probably was some inspirations, especially more or less them than me, because, you know, like parents worked in the plants, you know, and you seen all this machinery and stuff moving in the air in Detroit at the time. I didn't get to go to Detroit at a young age. I went later on in my life. Actually, I didn't go to the city of Detroit until I moved to Belleville with Derek May, and I was probably 16 years old when I first went downtown and seen the city that looked something like New York, but just smaller. You know what I mean? So, so it didn't affect me the same way, but I think it still played a role. And even when I went into the, you know, like I went into the Ford plant years later and looked at the machinery, you know, didn't inspire me to make the music I made because I didn't even know what an assembly plant really was. You just heard about it. But the fact that when I went in there, I was like, wow, you got these machines moving in time and rhythm. And, you know, it did have a correlation to electronics, and you can hear how you could actually be inspired musically. So that might have happened for somebody like Juan to give him his direction. And with the technology leading into inspiring people like myself and Derek, and just technology and the future and forward thinking.
Mm-hmm. You were in the Paradise Garage when you were like 13, 14 years old?
No, not that young, but I was 17 for sure, you know, 17. And like at 17, I had a full-grown beard, so there was no question of...
But Paradise Garage, New York, but you were living in Belleville at the time?
I lived in Belleville at the time.
But you only went into the city when 16, and then you just sort of got inspired with the city. So, or were you moving back and forth to New York?
Oh, yeah. I would go in the summertime to New York because my mother moved from Detroit. I mean, from New York to the suburbs of Detroit, where my father still lived in New York. So I would go back every summer, and sometime like in between, maybe a Christmas every now and then, or whatever, a holiday, a weekend, whatever. So, but mainly summer times. And I had other half brothers and sisters that I hung out with there, and cousins. So that's how I kept going back to New York.
Who introduced Paradise Garage to you?
My cousin, his name is Barry White, believe it or not. Not the Barry White, but his name is Barry White. Yes.
That's a beautiful one. Yeah. And he was like, yeah, let's like in the weekend, let's go. I know a place.
Well, I was just hanging, you know, like just hanging. He's older than me, and his group of friends, they were real cool and loved music, and I loved music and listened to mixtapes and listened to the WLBS on the, you know, on the radio, and you know, so I was just a part of all that as New York had their own type of disco mixing and on the radio and stuff. And one night they said, we going out to the Paradise Garage, you know, and I didn't know. I was just hanging, you know.
What year was this around?
I don't know. Maybe 81, 80, somewhere right around there. Had to be, you know. Because I graduated high school in 82. So it could have been, yeah, I would say 81.
So there wasn't so much house music back then.
It wasn't. There wasn't no house music.
Yeah, disco.
It was all disco and some European music, but it was a lot of disco. Evelyn Champagne King, Chaka Khan, Sister Sledge, Chic, McFadden and Whitehead, Ain't No Stopping Us Now. That was such a big anthem. Good Times from Chic. Supernature from Cerrone. Those were the tracks that, you know, I remember distinctively. And then as it evolved, because I don't even know if it was even 81. I think it was later than 81. It's hard to say. I can't remember. I'm getting old. So the reason I say that is because I did experience Larry playing house music at the Paradise Garage. So I'm not sure what year it closed, but I know like things took off for me like really 87, 88. So 84, 85, I had to be still going to the Paradise Garage, and it had to still be open because I heard him play Face It by Master C and J from Chicago.
I have to face it. Face it.
Such a big tune there. I actually seen Liz Torres perform that at the Paradise Garage. I seen there was another track called Hercules that was big. They performed at the Paradise Garage. Those are the two house tracks that I remember distinctively being played at the Paradise Garage, and I was like just waiting for my moment, because that was like me, you know, at the same time working on music and DJing at the same time.
I like the fact that you were moving your body when you said I was working the music. You were doing the shoulder shrug. You're like, I was working the music.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was a time, man. It was inspiring and just, you know, you're kind of reliving it when I'm talking about it at the same time.
Can you try to describe the atmosphere that was hanging around the Paradise Garage?
Well, as you walked in, it was like this long tunnel, I remember. It might have had like what they call a black light that made things glow, and you heard heard bass, like the thump of the kick drum. But you know, at that time, I didn't know what the hell that was. But you know, the first time. So as you go up, you know, as you get closer, obviously it gets louder, and you go into this room. And this room is packed, and it's probably like 99% men, I'm sure. I don't know if I had seen any women there. I can't remember because, you know, the men dressed like women, and you know what I mean? It was, you know, it was just like that. So, but it was a platform. Larry played like kind of up top, and you couldn't really see him. And it really wasn't about looking at the DJ compared to now, you know. It was more about just being a part of this room with this connection with people dancing and embracing and enjoying the music. And you had people dancing together, you know. I just danced with, you know, just danced where I was at, you know. I'm into the vibe too, you know. I caught my own groove, and you know, and you see people dancing, I guess, I don't know what the terminology would be called, but more flamboyant, that's the best way to say it. But they could dance too now. So it was actually interesting to see these men dancing to this music, like, you know, it was to die for, you know. So all that inspired me, and I just was in my own world, and you know, it, I think it opened up at 12 midnight and it ended at 12 midday. So when you walked out, when you walked in, it was night. When you walked out, the lights hit you. It was bright, you know, and you felt beat down too, you know, especially if the sun
was
booming.
It's a workout.
Yeah. But it was, yeah, that's the experience that, you know, it definitely played a role when I first started making music, because the first thing I could think about is how to make a track that will work on the dance floor, and that's on a loud sound system. And also, it wasn't just about instrumentals. I always wanted to make a vocal track as well, because that's how I grew up, listening to people like Chaka Khan and Evelyn Champagne King and Stephanie Mills. I could listen to them, I could dance to them, and that was like a early inspiration for me.
For Inner City?
Oh yeah, definitely. Even before Inner City, I did my first track actually was called Triangle of Love, and it was a vocal record. My very first track before I made any instrumental. Inner City, but it led to Inner City because my goal was to find the right formula to work in both club, DJs, radio, just in general.
And how were Juan and Derek reacting at vocal music at that time?
Juan was fine, because even though Juan didn't, his music he made, he did his own vocals. It was different. It wasn't like singing. It was kind of speaking, spoken words or stuff like that. And Derek, I think, you know, yeah, he thought, it's too commercial for me or whatever. You know, it wasn't really for him.
You need to slap him again. Listen to my voice.
Yeah. I know if Derek hated it, it was going to be a big record. I didn't know that. I hate that record. I hate it. That's what he would say, you know. But you know, Juan, you know, he helped me finish my first record, which was a vocal record. And Juan, give him credit, because he actually mixed the Big Fun. He did the mix. I was overseas or something at the time, and Juan, he mixed it for me.
Did he get the credits?
Yeah. The Magic Juan says the Magic Juan mix. I mean, he didn't remix it or anything, but he still made it sound like it needed to sound, and he had the experience of how to format it, you know, because he had more musical knowledge than all of us, you mm-hmm. know. So,
and Juan Atkins probably was the biggest influence in those early years, right, for you?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, he knew, before I knew I was making music, Juan had music on the radio, you know, in Detroit, at least. And I
with
was
the Electrifying Mojo, or?
With the Electrifying Mojo, and then the regular radio started playing, like, his Cybertron records, and he had, like, three or four records that were big, kind of Detroit cult kind of records that people really embraced. So I was like, yeah, I know that guy. I go to school with him, you know? So, and then, you know, I used to go over his house and stuff like that, too, and see, like, little pieces of equipment and stuff like that. So, and
did they go to Paradise Garage in those years, or was the distance?
I don't think Derek or Juan ever went. Yeah, they never went.
Pussies. But was that the Paradise Garage your first ever club experience?
Yes, it was. It was.
So it never got better, I think, over the years.
No, it was hard to beat the Paradise Garage, even though, like, in time, the Music Box in Chicago was quite special. And Frankie's place was cool, too, but it was like a baby Paradise Garage in Chicago. It was called the Power Plant or something like that. Mm-hmm. Can't remember. But the Music Box was quite unique with Ron Hardy. That was smaller, but same type of kind of crowd, except for Ron played different than Larry. Larry played more laid back, didn't miss his breaks, repeated records a lot. You know, you'll hear records sometime for 40 minutes, you know, because he'd start the beginning over and over again. The crowd loved it, too. They would cheer, you know. That was like, you know, that was popular to start the record over from the beginning or take the break and keep it going, you know.
And almost transcendental in a sense, right? If you hear a record like for 40 minutes, you come into this almost Fela Kuti type of playing.
Right. Well, it became melodic, but it also helped shape the path of what, as you thinking about making music, and like people like myself in the early days, I'm not like the skilled trained musician, you know. I'm not trying to do bridges, and I'm just trying to get the basics, get some good drums, make some subtle changes, drop out the kick every now and then, bring it back in, bring the bass line in, take it out, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But that was important because really that's what was an element that was missing in disco. Disco was still musicians playing, and it felt like musicians playing and human playing, where we took technology and made it more for the DJ and stripped it down where it was raw, but more effective in many ways because it was easier for DJs to play and it was better for people to dance to because they didn't mind hearing the same parts over and over again with subtle changes.
Yeah.
And in disco, you had to wait for that break, and the break sometime in disco records was the best part of some certain songs. Was like, wow, that's just an amazing section. Why didn't you just keep that like working, you know?
So
that helped, I think, the future when we started creating music.
Who do you think was a better DJ? Obviously, you've seen them both, Larry Levan or Ron Hardy?
Oh, they had really different styles. Ron was more innovative, like Detroit, especially like when you hear Derek play, if you've heard him play, he gets his style from definitely Ron Hardy, mm-hmm. you know, messing with the faders and EQs. Ron would drop out the EQs a lot. Not necessarily mess with the faders, but he would definitely drop down the EQ a lot and crossovers and stuff like that where you didn't really hear that with Larry. And Larry was just smooth and long, but you know, you couldn't tell, like, when the record was changing over with Larry. It was just perfectly mixed from what I can remember back then. But I would say Ron was more inspiring for me. But the Paradise Garage, as an overall, was more inspiring because the system was just better. Ron was, like, in a room maybe just as big as this. And it's just a sweat box. That's why they call it the box. And but they were rocking there. And sometimes he couldn't play too much house music, too. He couldn't play. He had to play, like, a lot of disco, which was good disco. But every time you played a house record, they would just go off, go crazy in there where, you know, you, for real. I mean, had to stop this record because it's about to be a, you know, earthquake in here or something. That's how it was.
And how was the male-female constellation at the box compared to Paradise Garage? And you're saying like 80-90%?
It was more female there for sure. Right. It
so,
definitely was.
So also less gay in a sense?
I wouldn't. Maybe so. I would think maybe a little. Definitely.
Was this an issue at any certain given time? I mean. Mm-hmm. Was this something that was talked about, or I mean, it's obviously something that people are talking about a lot right now.
It was never an issue for me because, you know, I was so into the music.
Yeah.
I never even thought about the fact that some man would try to hit on me, or I knew I wasn't gay, but it didn't bother me if somebody thought like I was in this place, like, you know what I mean, like you know. So it didn't bother me, and it seemed like, you know. It never even happened to me. So for me, it was the perfect environment and the best musical environment you could experience, especially back then.
Yeah, it's so funny that over time we got to, like, young kids got to get more knowledge about things, and knowledge is not always a good thing, I guess. Because if you don't have the knowledge about what it is, then you're just without any... You're just going in for the music.
House music was built on the gay community, the black gay community. But was it back then? Were you realizing this?
No, I mean, I knew it was definitely gay and it was black, but that's what it was at the time, and that was amazing. That was amazing for me. It was inspiring, and if you got to remember when I was going to these clubs. I was a music lover before I decided I was going to make music. I didn't have no clue. It was only a few years before I started making music, but you better believe if I didn't go to that Paradise Garage, then my path might have been different. I might not have made music. But the fact that I could hear first of all, I'm inspired because of Larry being a DJ, being able to take two records and keep it going, and then keep it going for hours, like 12 hours, you know, that's already like, wow, the beat never stops. That was cool. So that's the first thing. So then, you know, you want to become a DJ. But then, you know, you get inspired from your experiences and your influences through the love of music. And my path of music was Four on the Floor. And then also positive messaging was important for me, even when I started doing Inner City. So I wasn't like, even though hip hop was, when we started making music in Detroit, more or less Juan, as we evolved into it, hip hop was parallel really with techno, you know, NWA and all that stuff. It was really all going on at the same time. And the black community in Detroit was listening to techno at the time. I mean, Juan was like huge, and I mean, it wasn't like thousands, but the people that came out was really all black, and they were just loving this music. But hip hop came from the street, and it kind of took over. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was like, I want to do something more positive, more uplifting. And even though hip hop was from the street, I always felt like the grooves were great, the music was great, but sometimes I thought the message, I know a lot of times the message just wasn't cool for me. It wasn't me, and I wasn't feeling it. So that's why my path became that way.
Big Fun, Good Life.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say. All these positive track titles and, I mean, yeah, I'm just thinking out loud. It's funny that in a sense, techno has this... for a lot of people, this dark connotation.
Moody,
sort of.
Right.
But at the same time, like the start was super positive and about connectivity on the dance floor. fast forward, your first time going to The Hague, that must have been special as well.
Life changing, right?
Yeah, it was a bit different. It was a bit different, but you know, it was. I think The Hague was a cool city. You know, it wasn't like Detroit. It wasn't like New York, and it wasn't like Amsterdam. That's for sure. No. But it was a little more relaxed. You know, at the same time for me.
How did you end up there? How did you end up in The Hague?
I mean, first time Europe was England, right? UK.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
And then?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I was in the UK for a couple years, and then I experienced Amsterdam, actually, somewhere in late 80s, early 90s.
Do you remember your first time Amsterdam? Was it a gig? Was it?
It was something to do with inner city, and it might have been a conference. I'm not sure if we performed or if we. I'm sure we did, but I don't. That part is very vague. But I remember the scene. I was listening to like the radio, like when you get in the taxis, they play the radio. And I heard a lot of like house music. I was like, damn, they, you know, got it going on over here. It was kind of, you know, early days, but. And I remember coming back and eventually playing at the Roxy. I played at some warehouse parties here. And, you know, I've seen this whole thing grow from no festivals to 300 festivals. So, you know. But The Hague, the reason I ended up in The Hague was because of my wife. You know, I met her at Rotterdam, actually, at the Fast Forward Festival. That's, you know, I was doing that. And somehow we connected. And then I ended up being in The Hague and stayed out there for about a year and, you know, dated and traveled the world. And
you lived in The Hague for a year?
Yeah, about a year. I was riding bicycles and walking a lot, stuff you didn't do back at home. It was a different experience for me, but, you know, that's what love would do, you know, change some of your ways. And
love will get you on a bicycle in The Hague?
I definitely was, trust me. Yeah. Hell yeah.
And you're still with this woman,
yes,
from The Hague,
exactly,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
And but you didn't end up living in The Hague. You went back to the States.
Yeah, went back to the States because I got three boys that was prior to my marriage. So just had to go back and make sure I'd bring them up like young men. You know what I mean? and make sure they were dad's going to be there. So make sure I took care of that. And,
yeah. Yeah. So you did go back to Detroit?
Yeah. Went back to Detroit. She moved back. She moved there. You know, we got married and been there for whatever 12 years now. I think.
But now you're here for a couple of months.
Yeah, so. I've been here all summer since June. Me and my son Dantes, we've been touring with Inner City, and I've been DJing in between. You know, so decided to stay over here this summer. Because it was a little more intense schedule with the combination. It wasn't like me just DJing. It was inner city too. So it was like, I don't want to fly back every weekend.
Yeah.
Like every weekend and every weekend, you know. So
it's 30 years of inner city this year, right? 31?
Well, it's probably 31, actually. Yeah. 88 was when we first released Big Fun. So, yeah.
And now you're playing together with your son.
Yep. For sure.
And how is it to play with your boy?
Yeah, it's good because, you know, I've seen him develop over the since he decided he was going to take the path in the music. I watched him from the beginning to see his seriousness, his dedication, and his commitment to it all. So he's a big plus because he's the backbone of. The new music, the new sound, which is still a combination, but he can, you know, work on stuff as I'm traveling. He doesn't have a problem working and traveling. I'm pretty old school when it comes to that. I like to be in my studio only. So he can work anywhere, on a plane, in an apartment, you know, just to get a vibe. So, and then I can give him direction, and, you know, he's been working in the studio out here. Also, he's been in the studio 3, 4, 5, 6 times already. He's in the studio right now as we speak.
Huh. And did he always like your music, or?
Well, he just dealt with it because he was around him. He just heard, you know, trying to sleep.
He had no choice.
Yeah. He didn't have much choice. Went on some tours with me as a family. Yeah, sometimes I took him, like, to Australia, took the whole family or certain places. But he didn't, like, it wasn't his passion at the time. It became his passion as his friend stopped saying, "Man, that's your dad. He did that. Wow. Do you know?" And he's like, whatever. You know. And then he moved out, I think, when he was like 19 and lived with some friends, and or maybe 20, and they were DJs and they were aspiring to be producers, and that's what got him into music. It wasn't me. Mm-hmm. But the fact now he was into music, he stayed with him for about a year, and he moved back home. He's like, "You know, I really want to be a DJ. I've been practicing. I live with my roommates. I see equipment." He started talking about technology. And then, you know, he moved back home because he knew I had that studio too at home. And he's like, "I got everything right in front of me."
Yeah, sometimes you got to leave to see what you got. See what you got.
So that's really kind of how it happened.
And that's a funny direction, you know, though, to have the aspiration to become a DJ and move back into your parents' house.
I know.
My dad's got a studio. Fuck that shit. I'm moving back.
Going back home. I'm
fine. So what was the first thing you taught him or teached him?
Well,
were there any lessons?
Yeah, there definitely was some lessons. You know, I had to find out if he was serious. So first, you know, it's easy to ask dad a question. How you work this? How you work this? I told him, go look at YouTube. Go look at some books. Try to figure it out yourself. Once you got enough knowledge, because I wouldn't tell him right away, because then he's going to ask me every question in the world, right? Mm-hmm. I said, you try to figure it out. But I said, it's enough out here. I didn't have, like, all this technology of information.
Tutorials. No tutorials.
Right. So you can learn a lot. Even sometimes some people, it's too much out there. But at the same time, I could tell, like, when he started doing that and he started getting pretty good at understanding stuff, then I could tell, because the music never stopped. You know, down, like, in the studio, like, it was continuously. He'd stay up like 20 hours and then sleep 4 hours and then be up 20 hours. So then you knew, like, that's the bug.
Yeah.
You gotta have that first, right? Yeah. So you might have to spend 5 hours digging out one thing. Well, I had to spend 24 to 48 hours sometimes spending out one thing back in my time, because I didn't have the knowledge base, and I couldn't read the books, because the books, they were written so bad, you know, like, especially Roland, you couldn't understand what the hell they were trying to tell you to do. Like, what the hell are they trying to say? What kind of English is this? So once I seen that, I started taking him on the road so he could get an overview of what's out here. Then he did a tour. He came to Europe with me and toured, just hung out. And then he went on a tour with me with Richie Harton and Local Dice and a few people. And then, you know, he just started finding his own path and making his own connections, and just started, you know, being involved and getting involved and improving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, in a digital age, it's also completely different to create music. I mean, you started out on tapes, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Analog, tapes, boards, all that stuff. Splicing, cutting. You know, you would mix in sections, and then you would splice and do edits to bring it all together. Well, you know, these days you just do it all on the computer, do all your edits and arrangements.
Yeah, you get 60 layers if you want.
Right.
And then Juan also showed you that you could add all these layers and then double it, right?
Yeah. I learned that from Juan and Derek. And even when we were doing our radio shows, when I started DJing, like, you do radio shows, you do it the same way. You do special kind of mixes and try to do special things that was like a master mix, should I say. And in that master mix, you would just chop up different parts. You would, you know, make layers of records play together and then splice it together. So it continuously, it felt like it was two or three records mixing at one time. And so I learned a lot of tricks with that type of stuff. And, you know, the worst part is when you lost a piece of tape and it fell on the floor, and then you got a bunch of other tape down there and you're trying to find the piece to put back. That was a bitch. So definitely.
That's crazy, though, talking about the concept that the music that you made actually existed on something physical instead of like it, now it's like the horror is when your hard drive crashes or something.
But
it's
drops some coffee.
Drops some coffee on your. But everything is like zeros and ones, and then it used to be sort of something physical.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I appreciate both because I was a technology. I am a technology guy, so I like moving forward in the future. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, I like touching too. So like recently, I haven't mixed in the box in some years. I mean, I haven't mixed outside the box. I actually have a mixer again, and it's a digital mixer. But the fact that it's a DAW controller, and it feels, you know, like it's like an SSL type of approach towards mixing. Which to me feels great to just touch physical knobs and tweak your mix, or you can EQ right there on the board. That's just it's you know, when you're messing with the mouse, it's really not the same. It's harder to me, in my opinion, and it's easier with the board, and you feel it better with the board. So you can have two approaches. You can arrange your song and get it all like you think it should be arranged, and then you can start putting your effects and your compressors and getting stuff sounding right all on your board. That's a beautiful thing, because that's like two sides: create the music, arrange it, now make it all come to life on another way, instead of doing it all looking at the screen and doing this, and now you can do it on the board too. So for me, I like that way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Physical approach.
Yeah. I mean, it's both, but you know, it adds something, you know, something about pushing that slider up and hearing the balance compared to using it with a mouse and pushing it up. Because you sometimes you just never can necessarily get it like your ear thinks it should be. Well, this way, you feel like you can just automatically feel it. You can feel when it's right.
Mm-hmm. And actually, this weekend, me and Justin have been working for Lowlands, one of the biggest festivals of the Netherlands for quite some time. And now this year, we're doing a podcast. But for the last couple of years, I was the MC for a place called the X-Ray.
The X-Ray.
Yeah. Okay. So I was just curious on how you guys came up with this name. Just how did it pop into your mind?
Oh, X-Ray.
Yeah.
But, well, you know, that was really Derek. It was Derek May's project. But he had a track on the other side of that was, I heard, actually played in the Paradise Garage. I was just so amazed to hear it played. It's just a little small section on the, because it was called Let's Go, the name of the track, but on the other, it was no name. It was just an amazing track, one of my most favorite Derek May tracks, but it has no name. But X-Ray is Derek May, actually, you know.
All right, yeah. I thought maybe, because you sort of, I mean, you've always been called like a threesome in a sense.
Yeah.
Like
the Belleville, Belleville 3.
Belleville 3. Mm-hmm.
That's a better threesome. Name. Yeah. That's a better name.
No.
That's a better name.
But I know we've said about the past, let the past be the past, but just a short, how was the community back then? Was it
well we Derek, I think Juan was the knowledgeable one, the one with the experience, the one who's putting out records, the one you had to respect right away. And you know, me and Juan, we communicated, but we weren't like tight boys and nothing like that. Derek and Juan were really close. Derek was Juan's biggest fan, biggest salesperson. Like when Juan would release records, Derek would take them to Chicago and give them to like all the DJs, because Derek lived in Chicago for a short period after we finished high school. So Derek would be trying to push Juan's records. Derek is the reason why Juan met Mojo and got Mojo involved. So Derek was really the person.
And that was a big thing.
Oh, yeah. That was huge because, you know, Mojo started playing Juan music. And eventually, you know, Juan was doing stuff on the radio with Mojo. And we all were at a certain point and playing our music. But it opened up doors to people. And then gave us a lot of inspiration because we were right there at the forefront of you know, being played besides Parliament Funkadelic, Kraftwerk, and all these groups, you know, to get played by Mojo, that was special, you know what I mean? To be like, you know, that was credibility, instant credibility, and inspiration for you and belief. You know, it's great for your confidence. So I mean, as time evolved, we worked together, but we didn't work together. We worked to support each other. Mm-hmm. We didn't really make music together. You know, like Juan helped me finish off my first record. He did mix Big Fun. I got him, Derek and Juan, to do remixes on Good Life. You know, because I'm just trying to bring everybody into the picture as our scene is growing. But we all had our independent labels. Sometimes we shared equipment. Like, maybe Derek didn't have a 727, but I had a 727, but he wanted to borrow it because he wanted to just try something different along with what he was already doing. Stuff like that. We, mm-hmm. you know.
And you even had to give your sampler to Juan, right?
I had to give it to him. Yeah. Juan wasn't easy. He was, you know, I'll teach you this. I want that sampler, which was fine because I didn't really use the sampler. It was just sitting there. And guess what? Once I seen what Juan did, I was able to duplicate it myself, and I was off and rolling.
Yeah, you know. So it was worth it.
It was definitely worth it. Yeah. You know, it was definitely worth it. So, but we, you know, we still all communicate. You know,
you're in this app group.
Yeah, we have our own little. It's called Distinguished Men of Techno. And it's me, Juan Atkins, Derek, Carl Craig, Stacy Pullen, Kenny Larkin. It's basically us. So we always, you know, it's our own gossip line, I guess you could say.
Do you gossip about music or anything?
Everything is talked about. Politics, music, all kind of shit is talked about on there, you know, no doubt. Cussing each other out, you know, Belleville 3 tour, you know, we done had some wars on there too. We still stay connected. Juan and tuck himself off a couple of times and say, fuck y'all. That's real, but, you know, we still exist.
Maybe we could talk some more about the Electrifying Mojo.
Yeah.
Because were you a member of the Midnight Funk Association?
Yes, definitely. And I didn't know about Mojo until Derek. Derek moved in with me for like 4 months of school because his mother, for whatever reason, she had to move back to Detroit. She didn't want to take Derek out of the, like, you know, you go in two sections. First section, the first half of the year, the second half until the summer comes, then you're out of school. Mm-hmm. Well, she made a decision she was going to move back to Detroit and didn't want to take Derek out. Wanted him to complete the school year. So he moved in with me. Mm-hmm. And one of the first nights when Derek moved in with me, I, you know, I was like, I don't know, 11:30, 11:40. I was like, time to go to bed, man. I'm going to sleep. Cut the lights out. Let's go to sleep. And Derek was like, what?
What
are you talking about, man? It's almost time for Mojo. I was like, Mojo? He was like, yeah, the Midnight Funk Association. He said, you don't know about him? I said, nope. So that's how I found out about Mojo. So 12 o'clock came on, and I got to experience the whole Mojo, you know, vibe. And, yeah, I mean, you had whatever, honk your horn, flash your lights, put your hand up, whatever. It was like an oath.
But were you doing this?
I did it because, like, maybe not the first time because I was like, what the hell is this, you know? But definitely grew into it. And it wasn't something I did every time, but it was something. Mm-hmm. You would do something. If he said flash your lights, if you was near a light, you'll flash your light. You know what I mean? As you got old, if you was driving your car, you'll honk your horn, whatever, you know? So, yeah, I bought into it, and it was I think it was great that he educated.
This was a confirmation of the society, so you would drive down the street, and you would hear several people honk their horn.
Oh, like, definitely, yeah. Definitely. Especially if you went, like, later on in the years, if you went to Detroit, and they had a park called Belle Isle, and it was like everybody hung out there, like, just it was packed with people. So at that point, you see all kind of lights and horns flashing and blowing, you know, at the beginning of his show.
It's crazy to be able to sort of tap into this community so straight. I mean, Justin has been making local radio for how long?
10 years?
10 years. He's been on the local radio, The Hague Radio, every day.
Right.
And then, but I mean, if you would ask people to honk their horn, we should do a test. Actually,
yeah, we should try it.
we should try it out. Yeah, that would be nice. So to get you on the phone whenever you're in The Hague, or you come to the studio, and we'll try to get people to honk their horn. Let's see if it works.
Yeah, they got to buy into it. You know, it's all into the mental. And he at that time, we had nothing else to compare anything. That was so new. Think about it. It was just a new way of thinking. And it became like this cult of people that, this community of people that were on the same page. And the music wasn't all the same. I mean, like, you know, you had Parliament, you had Prince, you had Michael Jackson, you had Cybertron, you had just great albums, and that's what he played too. So he had a different way. So back in those times, what you would hear is on the radio, like whatever the single was, but you wouldn't hear the rest of the album unless you bought it, right? Yeah. But Mojo played the whole album. So it wouldn't be like, so he'll start out, he'll just feature whatever numbers or whatever, the whole album, and then just play every track off the album. What? Or go right into Prince and play the whole album. So that was crazy. Cool, you know? So now you became a fan of this artist.
And also get into the real world, the entire world, instead of just only
right.
cherry picking or...
Exactly. So that was different. And that's what made him so powerful.
How long did the show take?
It came on at 12. It might have went off at 3 in the morning.
And he
maybe
was like,
2, but I think 3. But I don't know how long it lasts, but definitely.
And he was a mysterious guy.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, you ever seen The Wizard of Oz?
Mm-hmm.
And you never see the wizard?
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of see him at the end, you know? Or I think you see him at the end. I know in one of the movies I've seen him at the end. But he's not what you expect, because he got this big, deep voice.
Yeah.
Mojo's like 5 foot, you know? I mean, he is. You know? And he's this short guy. You'd be like, that's Mojo?
Yeah, but you met the wizard in the end, right? I mean, you met Mojo.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. He's like 5 foot. I was like... That's Mojo. I was shocked. That's that deep voice.
Yeah, but that's maybe part of his strategy. Yeah.
Right. Like it's better, you know. People don't get to meet him, I guess. You know. So,
but that's where Moody Man got his vibe, right?
Yeah, Moody Man kind of got that. Yeah, he probably got it.
He doesn't want to show his face
and stays incognito and stuff like that. Yeah. Definitely. You know, you can't get. We try to get Mojo to come out like to a festival that I think Juan and Derek played in Detroit. It was like, you know, a Belleville 3 type of show, and try to get him to come out. He wouldn't come out, but he did like a thing and sent us to us like a tape.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
Is he still alive or?
Yeah. No, he's alive. He's very incognito still to this day, and you know.
Nobody knows what happened to him.
I don't even think he's done maybe one interview in his life. Like, he doesn't do interviews. He doesn't talk about his impact, or doesn't want to talk about, you know, his role, and, you know, just kind of let it live its own life. So many people don't offer him tons of money just to speak with him, but nope.
It's crazy.
And how about yourself now these days? Are you actively sort of... working on new music, reinventing yourself, or like, are you giving most of the control to your sons? How's this? How's the balance?
Well, it's a balance, because like within the city, my son is involved heavily. Okay, but you know, I still do my own stuff, like my e-dancer. You know, so I've evolved. I think a couple years ago, I've kind of recreated the same album that I put out in the 90s, just with some modification, mix it again, added 3 or 4 new tracks. And then we went from that into the orchestrated album, which was a lot of string bass, violins, stuff like that. But the same music, but transformed into, you know, more orchestrated and synth and violins and stuff like that, which, you know, gives myself a different challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a remix of one of the tracks coming out, I think Monday, next week. It's called Umbai. And so this new direction is a combination of now of violins and strings and dance. So like the last album was... It wasn't meant to be dance. It was meant to be down tempo, dramatic, dynamic type of album. So well, now I'm changing the path. I'm combining it. So where you have a section in the middle that just takes you in this world of strings and stuff, and it starts out very dance and underground, and you go into this section, and then it comes back into the dance after the. Experimenting around with the strings, and it's just working really well at festivals that I've been playing, and takes people kind of in another world, and all of a sudden just kicks back in with this power of darkness and underground. So you know, I'm always trying to recreate myself, because not necessarily for the people, because I'm inspired to do something always different or challenging.
Mm-hmm. Creating new things in order to stay alive, in a sense.
Yeah, just it's when you want to do something that inspires you at the same time, and it's also a challenge, and it's also experimental at the same time too. It gives you an opportunity to be free and do, you know, I've done some of everything, you know, I have nothing to prove, but at the same time I want to, I'm living. Yeah, so yeah, yeah. I'm going to do
proof
what
of life.
I feel like I want to do. Yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. Simple as that.
Is there a, you're living in Michigan right now, right?
Yeah, yeah, Novi, Michigan, suburb of Detroit.
And what is the scene like right now? Are you playing regularly, like over there, or are you?
I mean, I'm playing. I would say I play regularly enough in Detroit. 3 or 4 times a year in Detroit is good. I play during the festival. I do my showcase called Origins. I invite different people that either I collaborate with or have intentions to collaborate to play the festival. For instance, like Patrick Top, and I have a track coming out with Patrick. And he played on my stage last festival in Detroit.
Detroit Movement Festival.
Exactly.
Yeah,
Detroit Movement. So I do that. I do an after party. I did a track with Kink. You know, so I play in Detroit 3 or 4 times a year. I'm about to do an Origins tour in America, about 12 dates, a combination Canada, U.S., and some South American dates. So, you know, I stay busy.
Better days these days, I think, for DJs in the States, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think the States is much better than it used to be, because at one point it was like just like it was terrible. I mean, it went from New York, from the Paradise Garage days to the Sound Factory and some other good parties and the Tunnel and stuff like that for time. Then it got weird, you know, and that's because of the European music was being, the promoters were hiring a lot of European DJs, and they were becoming popular in America, and they were kind of shaping the sound of the club scene at that point, which, you know, which was, to me, at that point was a little bit damaging, but, you know, that's how promoters heard it, so that's, you know, so they were hiring less people like me, or Chicago was more about...
Damaging in what sense?
Damaging as far as, I think the education of the music, it was getting lost. It was like becoming this real progressive or just trance at the time type of market. So anything else that was being played, or, you know, they didn't, you know, if you're playing house, you weren't getting many opportunities to play house or techno. It was just really down to
EDM.
You had to be, well, this is
pre-EDM. Yeah, yeah.
So we went through a phase there where I thought, you know, America lost the plot. But, you know, they never caught on completely to what Detroit was doing, or what Chicago was doing, just Chicago itself, and New York, you know, they obviously Lil Louis Vega and Todd Terry, them, they were doing some cool stuff, but that was just a very small elite group. But as far as the whole country, San Francisco, LA, and all that, that's what I mean. Like, it kind of lost its plot, but now it's over the years and through technology and social media, people are more educated, and you know, you can't just you know, you can't, people can see what's going on around the world now a lot easier, you know. It's also caused more genres to be created and trap and everything else, but it's better now than it was back then because you can kind of be a promoter and just hide behind a certain sound or push a certain sound, and distributors and all that can really work together to kind of monopolize a scene, I think. I mean, but you can never really completely shut down the underground because that's why it's the underground. It, you know, so
you can never completely shut down the underground.
It's like the house and techno came from America and then we gave back the EDM.
You're right about that.
That's no doubt.
That's a horrible thing if you put it like that.
And then EDM became huge.
It became huge.
Good luck, guys.
But I remember going to Australia and me and Derek played this set, and it was with Deadmau5, I think, right? So we on this festival. They paying us really great money and all that. That part's cool, you know, in Australia. But, like, it was really like an insult, the stage. Like, so you think we all playing together, right?
Yeah.
So they got this, okay, I'm going to give you an example. Let's say 20,000 people, right? So they got this 20,000 people stage or area or festival, should I say, and we have three stages, right?
Yeah.
So one stage holds maybe, let's say, 12,000.
Yeah.
Another stage holds let's say 7,000.
Yeah.
They had us in a room where it was like 600 people. I was like, what the fuck? So I'm talking to the promoter. He's like, well, people just don't understand. I say, see, you're the problem. Yeah. It's up to the promoters to push all the music. Now, okay, I understand this is becoming popular and all that. Cool. But it's nothing. Why are you alienating the sound of good music, no matter what? Let the people make their choice. Let them experience some of this and some of that. So now America has become more of that, at least. So where you got different genres and, you know, I mean, yeah, the same people play at Ultra and that type of stuff, but it's better. It's better.
But and is it? I mean, it might be dangerous to say, but at the same time, fuck. Is it a white thing? I mean, the white people took, in a sense, the music and sort of made a show out of it.
You know, I think the music is for everybody. I think overall, it's controlled definitely more by whites. I mean, think about the black people who created music. Really, most of us from Detroit. Okay, we've been around forever and ever and ever, right? You know, we're only a handful of people. You know, what, me, Carl Craig, Stacey Pullen, Moody Man, Mike Banks, Underground Resistance, Jeff Mills, okay. But we've been around forever. So I understand, like, and other people were inspired. So so what I try not to do is say, like, if you're inspired and you want to make a track, that's cool. And if that's what you feel, that's cool. I'm trying to think of the best way to say it.
Just say how it is.
Well, I mean, I just think black people and the music that we create, we're overlooked because new promoters, they're not thinking about the past, and they thinking, and new promoters sometimes they don't even know or care this music, how it started. It's really about money. That's what I think. It's about money and who's marketable and who they want to make marketable, depending on management and all that shit, because all that plays a role now. When we started, nobody thought about all that. It was just the music, live for the music, play the music, die for the music. And now it's a whole different, you know, social media and all that stuff is, you know, you got agents who work with only certain management, all kind of stuff, you know, and politics going on with that type of shit. So, you know, so I would, you know, I mean, white producers, white females, DJs and all this, it definitely, it's the majority by far. So you're going to see more of that, which I don't mind. But I think, like, if you're talented, no matter what your color is, because this, when we create this music, my vision was for us to dance all together and all play together. So it should stay that way. And it's always somebody up and coming that's inspired to make music, whether they're black, white, whatever, mm-hmm. you know. But everybody don't think like me.
And so now you're with a Dutch company, actually.
Yeah.
With Armada.
Yes.
How did this come about?
Man, I'm trying to think. How did it first come about? I think I met someone. Somebody mentioned him to me that was from here in Holland, mm-hmm. and told me about him. So I just did a little research. I had management at the time. I think I decided to, like, let's do a label, potentially do a label type of deal. I think I knew Nicole, too, from some previous stuff, kind of asked some questions. And I just made my determination that I want to try to do something different. Mm-hmm. Somebody in Europe, I've worked with plenty of people in England and plenty of people in the U.S. And I thought, like, still wanted to have my own company. So, and they had a setup where, which would allow me to put out product from Detroit or from wherever on my label, KMS. They seemed very knowledgeable. Seemed like I had some good support. And then, so I kind of did that for a year or two with them. And then I was thinking about inner city, you know, at the same time. I think we put, like, some inner city stuff out on KMS. But then I thought, like, let's move inner city over to Armada, not KMS, and try to give it a bigger platform, a different platform, because it's, you know, it's a different direction than the KMS material. So, and I went and met everybody in the company, and it's got a good warm vibe and warm feeling, and seemed like they were music people, you know, and they were expanding and trying to do not necessarily one style of music, maybe diversifying. So I thought we would fit in. That's kind of how it happened.
There's like 50 or 60 sub-labels, right? They told us.
Yeah.
But they have some lousy coffee, I remember.
Yeah, they don't have no milk. They sure don't have no cappuccino. That's my only bitch about them.
You should put your fist on the table and say, yeah. I'm only working with this company. I'm a cappuccino type of guy.
Yeah.
You didn't tell the first meeting?
Put it in my contract,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I just read a story about a girl who puts out music at Warner. And they were talking about this deal. And she's like 19 or 20. Right. And she said, I want a dryer for my clothes. And then she got one in a Warner deal.
Okay.
Want to do my laundry.
There you go.
Yeah, you can ask next for everything.
One.
Yeah.
Next one. Cappuccino. It is.
And do you still look for a lot of new music?
I wouldn't say I look for a lot of music. A lot of music comes across our path, you know. And we try to listen to as much as we can. It's a bit overwhelming. You know, yeah. Dantes, he definitely, he listens as well as me, you know. So much music.
Yeah, but stuff to play when you're DJing.
Oh, yeah, I'm always searching for music. I probably look for more music than I do download of my promos. You know, people send me too, you know, because, you know, you get overwhelmed. Sometimes it's better. You feel like just searching is better than just going through a bunch of promos, even though you might have some good pieces in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a tough task when you got, you know, 15, 20 records being thrown at you a week or more, maybe 50, you know, sometimes. You know what I mean? So
it's
sometimes
easy.
And then if you feel like a need, like let's say you feel like, I feel like I'm missing something. I feel like I need some more inspiration. Then I'll go dig in promos and stuff. But I'll go to all the different sites and I'll buy, you know, and support, you know, the music. If I like it, I'll just pay for it and download it.
Is there one track that you've that's like still steady in your sets? Like you played it in the early days and you still sort of rely on it?
Yeah, I'll play Richie's track, It's Plastics, still, today. I played it Sunday, I think. I don't play it every set, but, you know, it's one of the songs that I still enjoy playing. I mean, it's a few I play, but that's one of the ones, it's raw, it's drums, it's got energy, it's some nice filter stuff going on, it just always works. So it just depends on when I feel like I want to pop it on.
What's going on now, like in the future? Can you take us?
Well, I mean,
on some plans that you got.
Really working on an Inner City album. Mm-hmm. That's
when
you
is it due to come out?
Well, I don't think there's a release date, but we finished probably about eight tracks that we're really really happy with, and we're gonna probably work on another 4 or 5, and you know, call it a day and. Let them out and put them out and put the album out.
And some more touring then? Inner City tours?
Definitely. We got to finish up the summer tour, which we almost finished with. Then we're going to come back in the fourth quarter and do about 7-8 dates in the UK and maybe a couple other parts of Europe. And let the music come out and get ready to tour again next year. You know, we have a fantastic performer. Her name is Stephanie Christian. She's actually a rock person. Her music background is rock. So she comes from a different way. She didn't grow up. She heard, obviously, her Big Fun and Good Life, stuff like that, and some of the bigger house records. But that was not her platform. So the fact that we connected... And she's singing right now. She's sung every song on the album, and you know she's our face, and going to be performing it. And
we'll be trashing the dressing rooms.
She ain't no joke. She jumps on speakers and all kind of stuff. We did a show in Berlin. I don't know the name of the venue, but the ceilings was really low. It was like really one of those places you really shouldn't do a live show, but but people appreciate it because it's so like underground and so like I don't know. The vibe was amazing, but the fact that they had a light, like see how you had those lights there,
mm-hmm.
But the ceiling was really low. So Stephanie's the kind of female that moves around a lot and she had a lot of power. Mm-hmm. She hit her wrist on the lamp and split it. So her vein. So as she was performing, blood was pouring everywhere. This is crazy. I didn't know if I'm going to stop the show. No, this is, you can't get no more underground in Berlin at that, right? So blood was like squirting out. So, you know, people run on the stage trying to bandage her. She's singing, "We're having big fun." And like, and she being bandaged up as blood is coming out. I was like, I hope she don't faint. I don't know if we should stop the show. And she just missed her her vein where it would have been like a whole nother level of seriousness. But,
wow.
You know, she had to get some stitches and, it, you know, all that. But she was a trooper, that's for sure.
And people thought it was part of the show.
They did. They thought she hurt herself purposely. It was like, but after they seen her all bandaged up, you're talking about cheers out of this world. She was just gone. So yeah.
And throughout the years, I mean, the process of finishing a track, did it change in any way? I mean, is there like, do you play it for your wife or your?
Hey, I still do some of the same things, listening in the car.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's always just something about listening to in your car, you know,
yeah.
Does it. Even on the phone now these days, you know, listening on the phone.
Does it pop out?
Right. Make sure you can hear stuff clearly. The process is still the same for me. Listen to it like 50 times till you hate it, and then you just say, let me not listen to it for another month, and then come back and listen to it. Mm-hmm. You know, testing it out, depending on if it's a club mix, you know, if you do a dance mix or something that's meant for the clubs, because sometimes it's meant for the album or mm-hmm. meant for more for radio. So, you know, if you do a club mix, you test it out. Where back in the day, the only way you could test it out is get it mastered and put it on lacquer. These days, you can get a good idea before you even get it mastered. You can master it yourself, or you can get it mastered, test it out, go back and change some things. So, you know, it's a little different these days. It's easier to make some adjustments, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's easy. With the digital, you can just test it out on an audience.
Yeah.
And you've been traveling all around the world. Is there a place that you, like recently, that you've been that sort of sparked your imagination or your feeling about music, like Asia or Europe, or
I don't know about music, but I went to Albania and I did this festival called the Kala Festival. I think I thought it was just a beautiful location. It's off the sea and the beach and the water. Some great food. Just real nice atmosphere. That was nice to see, you know. I mean, you're so used to seeing something like that, maybe at like Ibiza or Croatia. So it was my first time there. And I don't think they've been doing it for a few years. So I enjoyed that, you know.
That's crazy that the music is bringing you to all these places, right? Still.
Yeah. It's like I grew up in high school and, you know, you get your history books and you be finding out like Hungary and Budapest and all that. And you be thinking like, I ain't never going there. I don't even learn about these places. Then I find myself going to all these places. That's what's amazing. Like, it's like, you know, and then you come to Europe because first of all, I didn't think I was ever going to come to Europe. That just wasn't on my radar, my plans. And then you see like the history, and then you started thinking like, wow, America, we young compared to like these places. And you can start going and looking at these buildings and looking at some of the history, and like you get a better understanding of how we evolved over there.
Mm. The first time people from Europe try to book you or call you, did you think they were serious? It must have been such an abstract thing.
Well, the first time I had a connection, it was with a company called, Macola Records. It was a record company that wanted to license actually my record. I didn't know what the hell they were talking about, license my record. I had no clue. I had no clue back then.
But they phoned you because
they phoned me.
They phoned you at the house phone?
Yeah. Well, I had it like, well, it was my business line, but it really was like the house phone. Yeah. Yeah. You know, you put it on the label, but you're really at home.
Yeah, yeah.
KMS Records.
Oh, hi, Mom.
Yeah. So, you know, like, That was my first experience, and then it became eventually became Neil Rushton, who ended up becoming my manager, who was responsible for the for getting this compilation of the first Detroit compilation signed to Virgin or 10 Records at the time with all of us Detroit guys, the first compilation, and then as we then some bookings came in between, but they were really. Go through him. Then, I did some stuff, but the stuff I did was on my own was really U.S. based, and he did the stuff more European based, and it wasn't like the bookings like now. It was still all about making music, making money with music, putting out records on your record company. It wasn't so much about doing too many dates. It just wasn't. It wasn't a lot. At the time, in the early days, and it evolved over the years and grew into now agents and plenty of agencies and stuff like that. So
yeah, you can play every day if you want these days.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
And how's the musical climate these days in Detroit? Are there still lots of young producers?
It's not as many as I would think, or. We're not approached by as many. Like, I just recently did, like, a release. Let me think. One, I released Blake Baxter recently. He's been around. I did a track on him and a remix. I did a track with a guy called Nico. He's not young, but he's, he's not, like, one of the younger guys. I did a Taxia. I'm just trying to think, like, we don't seem to have a lot of the young guys yet, but I think they're there. I've been hearing it here, but we haven't heard their music or they haven't gotten it to us yet for whatever reason. So the goal is to, if there's talent there, to tap into it. But it seems like just like the same people or people who really haven't had a lot of opportunity to put out a lot of music have approached KMS and been sending in demos and stuff like that. But I suppose they got to be out there. I know Mike Huckabee's been working like in these schools and teaching like younger generation kids how to work the native instrument stuff and drum machines and machine and stuff like that. So, but I hear they're coming and they're there. So hopefully soon. But I haven't really, I can't give you one name that I can say like is somebody fresh and new and young, upcoming.
That's a bad thing, I think.
It can be, but hopefully they're there. It's just their time is not yet, and they're preparing, and it can't happen. I mean, we have an amazing festival. So, they got some inspiration, and, AC Pullen does his residency. I do my residency. Carl Craig does his residency. So we still actively, they're still, and then, there's a lot of different acts coming in to perform in Detroit. So there's no reason why that shouldn't happen, So I think it's in the making.
There was this little The Hague connection with this Detroit Movement Festival, right? With Olaf van Winde?
That was way back in the beginning. Olaf.
I haven't seen
Olaf in years. Yeah.
He's a very good friend of ours.
Oh, okay.
And actually I'm showing my art at Today's Art. This year.
So oh, okay.
I was in contact with him, so he's saying hi.
All righty. I haven't seen him in some long times. Yeah. He was involved mainly with Derek May when Derek was producing the festival for that year or two. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Derek lives in Amsterdam too as well.
Yeah. He lived in Amsterdam at some point. Stacy Pullen lived in Amsterdam as well. I think DJ Bones, a few of us.
Yeah, it's a strong connection.
Definitely,
I guess in a sense. Can you explain why? I mean, we can.
I mean, first of all, Amsterdam is just it's a cool place to be, you know, especially when the weather's right. You know, actually, this is perfect weather for me, like it is now. That yeah, stuff,
a little bit rainy.
Yeah, a little bit rainy, not too hot, because you ain't got no air conditioning in most of these houses. So, like, either I got to have air cold or be just like this. So, you know, a few weeks ago or so, that was not cool. That was not cool. I was like, I ain't never getting an apartment in Amsterdam again. Or it's gonna have air conditioning. So I, you know, for me, it's just a good platform. It's easy to get around. It's got great transportation. The people are cool here. Mm-hmm. You know, the different types of foods, it just all works. You know, really works. And you know, it's a good port. It's reasonably fair priced for, you know, what you get, you know, mm-hmm. not in London paying like three times the rate, you know, stuff like that. So it's a lot of reasons why, you know, I don't smoke and get high and all that. So that part I can't say, you know, but some people do, and it's perfect because mm-hmm. you got the, what do you call them? Coffee shops, right?
Yeah.
You know, I stopped smoking when I first came to Amsterdam. I stopped like a year before then. So can you imagine, like, I'm young. I'm in Amsterdam, and I can be at a coffee shop, and I can smoke weed legally and different types of weed, but I never tried it. I never did it.
Why did you? Because you were smoking.
I smoked at a young age. I probably was smoking at 16 and done some of everything before I was 20, and then I was done.
What happened?
Well, I didn't like it. It was really simple. I didn't like it.
You just tried it for 4 years, and then you were like, nah, it's not for me.
Yeah, maybe in the beginning I liked it a little, and then, you know, I started getting paranoid and all kind of shit. I was like, a panic attack. So I was like, I don't want to do nothing that make me feel that way, you know. Mm-hmm. So it didn't work for me, which is fine.
Yeah, of course.
It's all cappuccino.
There you go.
and just for in Paradise Garage, were they selling drinks or anything over there?
Just juice, and fruit, and I mean, but people did drugs there. That's for sure.
Oh yeah.
They did, especially whatever, I don't know, acid or LSD. Or I don't know what to call it, but they did that stuff to keep them up for 48 hours or 20 hours or 12 hours, whatever. But but it was no. I never seen an alcoholic drink in there ever, you know.
I'm wondering just if that would still work, but it would take out.
I don't think so.
It wouldn't work now, but it's. I mean, alcohol is one of the most aggressive things out there. If you take out the alcohol part, that would be just amazing, I think.
Yeah.
When they're taking drugs, because otherwise nobody's dancing. I think. Yeah.
So, and are you a good cook?
Yeah.
I'm a decent cook. I like to cook barbecue stuff. I grill a lot, and you know, I when I go home, my wife don't cook. I cook, you know. So, oh yeah, when I go back now, I can't wait to cook. So, she can't wait for me to cook.
She hasn't eaten in months.
Well, she can cook now, but you know what I mean. Like if I'm home, she ain't thinking about cooking, and then you know. But I mean, I experimented. I try to cook Thai food, you know. Right. So, I mean, pastas, that's usually pretty easy to cook. But my specialty is really grilling and barbecue and special sauce for my barbecue. So when I go back, I have a special cookout coming up on the 31st of
really?
August. Family and friends cookout. It's the Saunderson's family and friends cookout. So I do it every 2 years, so.
What's
happening?
Yeah, maybe we should come and visit and try some of that special sauce.
Hey, it's pretty good.
Yeah,
it's pretty good.
I mean, we're bringing out a cookbook.
Oh, okay.
For ADE.
Oh wow.
So
we need a recipe.
Yeah, we need to get
Seth Roxler, he told us about this barbecue sauce.
Yeah, I haven't had his, but I've heard his was good. But I haven't. I was in Ibiza. A few weeks ago, and he was, him and his mother were cooking for somebody over there, some barbecue for their birthday. But I couldn't go because I had to do an inner city sound check at the same time. And the show wasn't too far after, so I was bummed. Like,
oh, shit.
I still haven't been able to taste it.
He's a chef.
That's what I hear.
Yeah,
I hear he's a real deal. So I'm a wannabe chef, but I
think because I saw him in Barcelona a couple of weeks ago, and he told me that he wants to have his vegan tacos in the book, cauliflower.
tacos. So if we would ask you for a recipe, what would be in the book?
What's the signature
What's
dish?
What's your signature dish?
It'd be probably barbecue ribs. Yeah, with the special sauce. Definitely.
Barbecue ribs with the special
sauce. But the special sauce is a secret, right?
Oh, yeah. That's it's hard to really give all those ingredients up. I might give you part of the secret, but that ain't good enough. Somebody might try it and say, like, hey, this is just okay. Then they come to my house and be like, wow.
Wow. All right. Well, maybe you can give us another recipe, which you will.
Or invite us for the cookout.
Just invite us for the cookout. I mean, how far is it? You know, we'll bring our bikes.
It's only in Detroit. Suburb of Detroit.
The world is a small place.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you so much, man. Thank you for stopping by. Have a good stay in the Netherlands.
Yeah, they got a week left, a little over a week. I've been here all summer, so I'm looking forward to finishing up my tour and getting home for about 10 days and enjoying my barbecue and then shoot off to Australia.
Only 10 days? Yeah. 10 days off and then
Australia. Yeah.
For how long are you staying?
Just Australia? Just 2 weekends, which is good because I'm not doing like Japan and Singapore and all that this time is too much. So just shoot in 2 weekends and come back home and start working on American tour.
And next summer you'll be back in Holland tour?
I'm sure I will, as long as I find a place with some air conditioning.
We'll get you some in The Hague.
You probably can get some in The Hague.
Yeah, you should come home. bring the lady home.
Yeah,
to
we can ride some bikes.
You know, my wife came over for about 2 weeks, but if she was going to be here all summer, we would stay in The Hague because that's closer to her. I mean, that's her environment. But because she was only here for 2 weeks, it was like, I'm staying close to Amsterdam.
So. Yeah. We still want to know which neighborhood she grew up in. I mean, we'll get back to it later.
Yeah. I've been there many times. I don't know how to tell you, though. Yeah.
Welcome anytime, man.
Alrighty.
Welcome anytime.
Thank you.
Alrighty. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Alrighty.
Yeah.
That's a wrap.
That was a nice conversation. Huh?
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
That was nice. But
I did something like this in Berlin not too long ago. That was one of the better interviews. It's just like a talk, and it makes it different than just like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.